legally you can't ask for any money. And so the way to get around that is people can do tarot reading as long as they don't have any display saying they're asking for money, you know, but you can talk to people. Like when people come up and be like, yeah, I want a tarot reading, you can be like, well, I take a donation, you know, like, you know, and work it from there.
Well, I know that if you look at the law, it is incredibly complicated. I'm sure you've looked at it.
I've studied it quite extensively when they were citing me for it. But I actually filed a complaint against the police officer that wrote me a citation, and it was sustained by both the police officer review board and the chief of police.
Wow, that must be a first.
For a wrongful arrest complaint.
Wow, and what year was this, Ian?
God, it must have been like 96 or something.
And you remember the arresting officer?
Yeah, it was Officer Seeley, young Seeley, the blonde hair, the guy who's in charge of all the homeless people now.
Oh, yeah. Much beloved and not much beloved, unfortunately,
yeah.
Most people.
But that was the author. It's funny because Lefebvre wrote it, and then he was like, I was telling him, I'm like, you know, law says that. I got a right to be doing this, man. And he's like, they're like, I don't think you know the law very well. But then, like, Lefebvre backed out and said, oh, Seeley, you want to sign this? And he said, okay, and he signed it. So he got the complaint.
Wow, that's interesting news, Ian. I know that... I have never seen a more complicated law than this law.
Metaphysical science.
Oh, what's the point? I mean, I guess they're afraid of fortune
tellers? Yeah, when you look at the case history going back, you know, in other cities and states, the courts say they have a right to protect the gullible. And therefore, there's, like, laws set up so that if you, for instance, are working at the Sacred Grove and you do tarot readings, you know, you got to get licensed by the city to do tarot readings.
I mean,
there are certain laws, like you have to display how much you're charging, you know,
There's a huge law about having to get all kinds of police permits and recite every place you've ever been, every criminal conviction you've ever had.
When I got a license for that, I didn't have to go through that stuff.
Really? Interesting.
No, I just filled out a piece of paperwork.
Wow. Well,
and put it in.
So, there are tarot readers who can actually do this for money in town? Is that actually exist, or...?
There are. Like, at the Sacred Grove, you get a tarot reading.
So, they're not about to raid the Sacred Grove?
No, I'm pretty sure they're licensed. You know, because they haven't got, like, messed with by the cops for that.
And they
so
actually do...
I don't know, though. Yeah. You know, I'm kind of... I don't know for sure.
Right. Well, I appreciate the update on that, and...
Yeah. And again, just, like, don't have any sign that says for donation or anything like that. And you can do it on the street, you know. And if the cops try to mess with you, you know, I was told by a lawyer that I screwed up by not suing the city.
I agree.
He said that I was sitting on top of a little gold mine right there for that wrongful arrest, because the law says very explicitly that you have to be charging money, and if you're not charging money, then you're not guilty of a crime.
Right, and I think the point here is not so much, you know, to milking the city for a little money can't be bad, but
yeah.
The idea that this is kind of sloppy police practice and this kind of we do what the fuck we want stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta rein them in.
I went to a 3-month like citizens police officer class or whatever where they talk. You know,
citizen
I went
police
to the police
academy,
department every week, and they talked to me about the police stuff. And what I got out of that. But they don't really give a shit, like, about complaints. The only thing they care about is getting sued. In fact, they train their officers on, like, what they can do and not get sued. You know, that's really where they draw the line.
That's why I think we need to have more citizens who know how to do lawsuits without, you know, having to, you know, persuade some lawyer, because lawyers often don't want to take these lawsuits.
There is a lawyer I know of that, I can't remember his name offhand. I'd have to call another friend and ask him what the guy's name is. But there are lawyers who will sue the police department or whatever.
There are, and often those are out of town lawyers. I mean, they're very.
There's a guy who lives in Santa Cruz.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know his name offhand. I can maybe call you up like next.
That'd be great.
Like that.
The street performers, as I mentioned, are meeting today, and I think they need some legal muscle. Frankly, you know, that's what they need.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, they aren't going to get together a lawsuit though unless. You know, the police do something that's in violation, you know, whatever, like unreasonable force or something.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, I appreciate the call, Ian, and
all right.
Keep us posted.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Robert.
All right, man.
Bye.
Yeah, I mean, so it is possible to, boy, that's a rare thing to find a man who has taken a complaint all the way through, had it sustained by both folks, and that's, of course, that's the time when you want to file the lawsuit. Well, but often, you know, there are other things that happen that stop you from doing that. I know we were falsely arrested, I guess, back in 1989, a bunch of us at the Denny's restaurant because we supported a woman's right to have a cup of coffee there. They were trying to kick her out with this weed, defend the right, reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. And we said, well, if you're going to kick her out, you got to kick all us out, too, and we're not leaving. And they called the police and had us all arrested. But it was an illegal arrest. There is no such right to refuse service. You have to have some cause. There's a Public Accommodations Act that does not allow discrimination on the basis of appearance. It doesn't allow discrimination on the basis of race, religion, gender. I don't know if it's sexual preference yet. So I thought we had, you know, it was pointed out to us, attorneys thought we had a legal cause to sue, but I was trying to be nice to Denny's. Big mistake. Don't be nice to these folks. Kick them in the balls, you know, or in the ovaries, as the case may be, and just proceed to get justice, because that's the only thing they're going to listen to, is at the ultimate level, is some kind of potential force. I say this not as a person who believes in force. I don't. But I think that the idea of making nicey talk with merchants and police when you don't have anything to back it up is really flapping your jaws and wasting your time. I mean, I know plenty of nice merchants and nice police officers. It's just when they get into their official roles seem to be repressing those who are of lower, quote-unquote, classes. And that is something that just has to be fought. You cannot, you know, schmooze or smile it to death. Doesn't work. And that's, I guess, what street performers are going to be trying to do when they meet today, and then the more groups of people meet tomorrow. And we then come to the city council on week Tuesday, on the 14th. I guess it may be the evening or the afternoon, probably the evening session, when these absurd laws are coming back again, the Matthews-Rotkin laws. Originally pushed by Riley and Porter. Boy. I've got a couple comments about what Kennedy was saying. You know, Kennedy has a nice way of sounding very moderate on these issues, but what he says is filled with really a bunch of misstatements and also things that raise some interesting questions in my mind. For instance, he talked about this round we didn't deal with the issue of artists being allowed to sell their own work. And he went through this lawsuit that the city had against people who are selling generic T-shirts, I don't know, like down in Monterey or something, that it signed on to, or maybe it was here in Santa Cruz. But this has nothing to do with real artwork that you're selling of your own, which is, you know, limited and doesn't take up much space and doesn't serve any kind of real competition, but it's really more of a draw for merchants around. It's just narrow-minded and short-sighted to go after this kind of stuff, and it also criminalizes a bunch of people who are struggling just to be able to get enough to come in out of the cold to pay for the gas in their vehicle that is their temporary home. And it's just saying we're not dealing with it this round ignores the fact that Kennedy was on the council for 8 years and he didn't deal with it in any rounds. He had 8 years to deal with this issue of decriminalizing artists and musicians who want to sell their stuff or seek some kind of, you know, assured donation for it. That's what I used to say when I sold the street shit sheet on the streets, the homeless newsletter that I used to publish and occasionally still write. It didn't say suggested donation, it said mandatory donation. You got to pay for this. And police tried to bust me on different occasions, and, you know, I said, good, you know, make my day, and they backed off. Just as we'll be reviewing later what happened downtown yesterday at Sushi Now and Kathy Campesino, the new occupant of the former Alibaba's cafe site in front of New Leaf Market. What else did Kennedy do? He claims that we're not moving in some draconian way to eliminate music on the mall. Well, they are moving in a draconian way, the council is, to eliminate music on the mall. That's not the motivation, per se, but that's the effect. And when you will the effect, then you will the consequences. And the fact of the matter is that's what they're doing. And they're doing so, as I said before, because the city council, wants to fluff up the merchants and, you know, reassure them that all is well so they can, actually they did this last summer, so they could, you know, no doubt get some, you know, a few votes in the electoral column, but also because there's, you know, this, there was this Proposition P that was threatening to deplete Dick Wilson's coffers and the city and the police department coffers, and as well as social service coffers, parks and rec coffers. And I think there were there was an ulterior motive in rushing through a bunch of ill-advised and unconstitutional legislation. One of the problems, as I think Ian, who just called in, pointed out, is that there was no legal opposition to this. For instance, and then one can see the difference. In 1993, for instance, when then-mayor, now Bookshop Santa Cruz owner Neil Coonerty brought up an almost identical move-along musician's law, which said he couldn't be in one place more than an hour, and he had to move along and you know, go 100 feet, and then he couldn't come back for 24 hours with your display or with your music. A couple of ACLU attorneys came to this discussion and said, we're going to sue you if you do this. And that ended the discussion. They stopped. In 1994, threats of a lawsuit didn't stop the downtown ordinances, because now we had this alliance between former liberals like Kennedy and the businesses downtown. In the wake of the earthquake, they were going to have this great new, we don't have to be progressive anymore, we're the pals of the merchants attitude. And it passed. They passed this completely draconian sitting ban, as well as a bunch of other stuff, criminalizing street performers who were standing next to buildings and in front of cafes. But it was turned back by massive protest and by lawsuits. Attorneys like Kate Wells, Margaret Marr, and others successfully took to court and had all charges against all protesters dropped and actually overturned the sidewalk sitting ban. Kennedy then, Bravado being his middle name, urged Barisoni, the attorney, to appeal it. I don't know if they actually did appeal it, but what they did instead, I think, was they substituted another law. They passed this the law that we've had for the last 8 years, which is it's illegal to sit 10 feet. Now it's 14 feet anywhere on the sidewalk. And this notion that you're setting up these sanitary cordons where people can walk along, where there'll be no sitting, no hacky-sacking, no bubble-blowing, nothing, the idea that a person can't walk around this is absolutely preposterous. And the idea that everybody else should be criminalized to succumb to the apprehensions of a few paranoid people really pisses me off. And you heard Kennedy saying, well, we heard some real concerns about real community members. I'm not saying that there weren't, on occasion, those kinds of concerns, but they aren't dealt with by that kind of legislation. Talk about that in a moment. If we have the time, we have an incoming call. Hi, you're on free radio. Sorry. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Aha, and who do we have on the line here?
We have Jennifer Yellowhorse from Santa Monica, Ventura area of California.
Sounds good. If you can speak up, I would love it.
Okay. I'll certainly try to do that.
That's good. So
how are you today?
Say that again?
How are you today?
I'm good. It's the weather is mellow up here after a lot of rain, but we have, of course, the city council's usual shenanigans. They're going after street performers up here, and I understand that while you, I don't know, what's happening with street performers in Santa Monica? Are they allowed to play their guitars with an open case and a donation sign or not?
Well, if they have a permit, they do so, and they have to move every so often. I think it's like every 30 minutes or so, each performer has to move to another space.
This is sort of the exercise the performer's resolution?
Yes, and I believe that there is a cost associated with the permit, and, you know, so they make sure that everyone is in a revolving door policy around the 3rd Street Promenade.
Now, is that only on the 3rd Street Promenade, or is that everywhere in Santa Monica?
Well, I think that it is in the downtown area specifically, mm-hmm. and there really isn't other places where people would be able to do that type of performance for folks, because the 3rd Street Promenade in the downtown area and on the Santa Monica Pier where this is a fact, those are the only real areas that they can go in order to do public performances. The rest of the areas are basically residential.
Huh. Now, does that mean it's barred in residential areas, or performers just don't do it there?
Performers just don't do it.
I see. And how long has this law been in effect, you know?
About a year.
Oh ho! So maybe we got it from Santa Monica, huh?
Oh, you probably did.
Well, what happened?
But I hear that yours is a little more restrictive than ours. More specific.
Well, it sounds like it's the law that's being proposed for the January 14th vote is you can only play for an hour. So yours is apparently more restrictive than being half an hour. You can only do it. You can come back after 24 hours, and you can also you have to move 100 feet. Why did your law go into effect? I mean, was there an outcry against street performers, or were there some murdering street performers who were killing people downtown, or what happened?
Well, it was basically an outcry from the downtown business district, the Bayside District Corporation, and they basically felt that the street performers affected their business and, you know, kept people out of their businesses, and so they sponsored the legislation and it eventually passed through our city council. And there was, you know, a great deal of opposition, but not from the business community itself. So, therefore, their voice became law, and ours didn't.
What was the vote on your council?
I'm not exactly sure what the vote on that particular item, how it went, but I think it was like 4-2 or
your Green Party mayor, Michael Feinstein, who I guess he was mayor, I don't know if he is now.
Yes, he is. Is
he on the good side or the bad side?
Well, he's on the good side in certain ways and on the bad side in others. But I think that their voices get drowned out because there is a hefty deal of organizing on, you know, from the business community and especially around, you know, election times. And really push their agenda forward so fast and so strongly that it doesn't really matter what, you know, one or two council people say as long as they have the majority on the council.
Did anybody actually cite any real stats that indicated either people couldn't walk past or that they were being abused by musicians or that, I mean, were there any substantive arguments made that, you know, an objective person might sort of say, well, there's a consideration we have to take into account. Because we're having meetings up here today and tomorrow to try to realistically consider real concerns. Now, were there any real concerns as far as you're concerned about these street performers?
I think the most substantive argument that the business community put forward was the fact that in a crowded downtown district that, you know, people would gather around the performers and therefore it would be hard to get around them. And so that access to, you know, being able to, you know, walk through the street, you know, was the main concern without, you know, having any problems. And, you know, then there were minor arguments about, you know, litter and things like that. And, you know, there are certain people out there. I believe there's a guy who has two cats that he says, you know, are they can see into people's eyes and, you know, stuff like that. And I think that there was some discussion about animals on the promenade. There was another guy, I guess he had, you know, some kind of a mouse or a gerbil, and people were concerned about, you know, the quality of life of the animals and, you know, the... and how they would affect, you know, average city persons.
This is the same city that has
poop or pee or something like that in public.
Perhaps they could set up some restrooms for people and their animals. How's the restroom situation in Santa Monica?
Well, it's pretty tight. Most of the public showers are closed due to renovations, timely renovations. And so basically, those public showers have been closed at Memorial Park, which is on 14th and 14th Street in Santa Monica. And so, you know, the ones under the pier are limited in their open times, I think, to like 6 to 8 in the morning. And basically, most people who use those shower facilities are referred to social service agencies who are open Monica has not really done a whole lot in terms of, you know, making restrooms available, especially after, let's say, 10 o'clock at night. But I believe that there was a recent proposal by the city to direct staff to discuss making restrooms more available during those hours. But so far, nothing has come forward. And basically, that discussion came up as a consequence of our recent ordinances that were passed about sleeping in doorways.
Tell us about those ordinances, Jennifer.
Well, we have two ordinances. One restricts outdoor meal distribution programs from serving free meals in the parks to homeless people. And the second ordinance is a citywide ban on sleeping in doorways without permission from the property owner. So basically, an officer who sees someone sleeping in a doorway can approach them and remove them without permission from the owner in order to do so. So those are two ordinances that we have, and the motivation behind them was that most people were using the doorways to use the bathroom. So an argument, you know, straight away came forward about the lack of access for homeless people to be able to use the restrooms because they're mostly closed when they need them and would have to travel, you know, from the places that they traditionally sleep in order to get to them. So that came forward, but city staff hasn't moved on that suggestion at this time. So, but we do have our two new laws, and we recently, actually on January 3rd, launched a lawsuit against the city of Santa Monica on behalf of the outdoor meal distribution programs to put a stop to the city's enforcing of the new ordinance controlling outdoor meal distribution.
Tell us a little bit more, Jennifer, about this no feeding ordinance. I know that they tried this back in 1992 or 93.
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
And did it fail then, or was it overturned? But what happened back then, and what's the difference between the ordinances now?
Well, it was overturned then because of it wasn't constitutional to, you know, say whether or not a person could, you know, serve a meal in a park or a public space. And the difference between that law and the new ordinance that Santa Monica has passed is that they are requiring permits for organizations who, you know, feed more than once a month, and that they would have to adhere to all, you know, the food laws by the health department, that they would have to adhere to health department codes, and which, you know, would cover basically the temperature of the food, the preparation of the food, and the distribution of the food, and which would, you know, for a picnic in the park is pretty strict, you know. A lot of average people would not be able to adhere to health code requirements. And it also adds on a permit to do so. So, you know, a group would have to apply for a permit, pay for police enforcement of the area, pay for trash removal, and in order to provide food, and it would also limit the numbers of people who would be served under that.
It sounds like it's not designed to protect the health of either the public or the poor and hungry people being fed. It is designed to discourage food servers.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that the city of Santa Monica, and what's different than, you know, the past laws that Santa Monica has put into effect, is that the city adamantly claims that they care about the health of homeless people and want this ordinance to make sure that homeless people are taken care of and are not, you know, going to be placed in danger by eating food, you know, from a food program. However, these same requirements are not, you know, imposed upon your average dumpster, which many homeless people will have to go to in order to get replacement food for what they received with the outdoor meal distribution programs. And one of the most compelling arguments that the city of Santa Monica put forward is that most of the people who serve food in the parks and open spaces are attracting homeless people from everywhere, all over the United States, by providing food in public in Santa Monica. So, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and a juice box and a cookie is what motivates homeless people from all over the United States to come to Santa Monica.
Hang on. I'm heading south right now. Let me go pack my bag.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Sounds pretty tasty.
Come to Santa Monica, because we have sandwiches here.
Now, has that, in fact, had an impact on the food services? Have a lot of food services stopped serving, or?
Well, the most interesting thing about the food programs who serve in the parks is that most of them are religious-based institutions and do not want to break the law. I mean, they basically feel that in order to break a law that they, you know, would be putting themselves in some type of confrontational behavior with the city. So many of them are considering halting their food programs based on, you know, this law because, A, they don't want to break the law, but, B, they also would not be able to go through the permit process in order to continue to serve food. And so there are some outdoor meal distribution programs who, regardless of the law, will continue to serve groups like Food Not Bombs and Helping Other People Eat. And
when did the law go into effect, Jennifer, or has it gone into effect?
It went into effect, I believe, on January 1st, and it was supposed to be applied as law, I believe, on January 3rd, and that's when the lawsuit came forward and was filed challenging the ordinance.
How many food servers are impacted by this who had regularly been serving food, and how many people are affected?
Well, from our estimations, and which I think are significantly different than the City of Santa Monica staff, you know, idea of how many food programs are out on the streets, I think about 5 food programs who serve regularly will be affected. And the effect is that, you know, the increased police presence at the programs, the increased, you know, paperwork that they would have to do with the city, and, you know, basically making it uncomfortable for a lot of the volunteers to go out without expecting some type of confrontation with the law. And so we've had a number of nonviolence trainings and organizing meetings for food programs to really plan what they want to do with their time. Now that the law is going into effect, in order to continue to provide food to people out on the streets. And
Jennifer, how many people does this impact?
In Santa Monica?
Yeah, how many people use these meals?
Yeah, we have approximately 1,000 homeless people who, according to the 2000 census, exist on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say about 500 of those people would be affected.
And are these people who commute in from L.A. and San Diego for the sandwiches and then sort of take off the next day, or?
Well, apparently they come here for a sandwich and then they stay, according to the city.
So this is really it's like drawing rats, in other words.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, Santa Monica does its fair share for the homeless and feel that other communities, surrounding communities like Malibu, Beverly Hills, Culver City, should be doing more for their homeless population. And as soon as this ordinance, you know, went into effect, the city of Los Angeles, their city council is proposing the same type of ordinance there to restrict meals in their program. So the city of Santa Monica wants to encourage surrounding cities to do more, and instead these other communities are choosing to do less by affecting the same laws.
Now, didn't Los Angeles have a court ruling that, in essence, kind of protected, A, panhandlers, and B, folks down in the Skid Row encampments?
Well, they do have, like, a safe zone downtown, but as far as meal distribution programs, these laws are not aimed at the homeless, per se. Who they're aiming it at is housed people in community groups or church organizations who go out and provide the meals. So this is
the enablers of the homeless.
Absolutely.
You're making it easier for people to be homeless.
Absolutely. And if a person, you know, gets that's hungry enough, maybe they'll come in for our continuum of care of social services and actually take the help that we want to give them.
And what kind of help is that in terms of is there affordable housing or even emergency shelter for Santa Monica's homeless people?
Well, in Santa Monica, we've eliminated rent control. So rent control was the way that prices were kept affordable for most people to be able to live in Santa Monica. Now that those rent control units are mostly gone, the rents around here have skyrocketed. What used to be, a $500 to $800 a month apartment now goes for about $2,500 a month. So your average person on welfare wouldn't be able to move into Santa Monica anymore. In fact, myself, I've had to look for housing, and I couldn't find anything in Santa Monica that I could afford. And what Section 8 programs we do have are severely restricted, and you can't access them. And so it really makes it difficult for, people of low income to be able to stay in Santa Monica. So basically they're saying, if you can't afford to live in Santa Monica, then you need to find another place to live. You need to relocate somewhere else.
Now, on Thursday, we got an email from either you or folks you're working with down there,
mm-hmm.
and I want to point out we're talking with Jennifer Yellowhorse, who is one of the editors of, is it now called Making Change?
Yeah, Making Change.
The local street newspaper, which has vanquished the mighty foreign London-based Big Issue paper, which attempted to come in and swamp your market. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We managed to outweighed them, and they dismantled and went away.
Yeah, the big issue is still doing its big deal over in London. But as I mentioned to you earlier off air, John Bird, who's the head of the Big Issue, was recently quoted on the front of the Sunday Tribune, which I happened to see in a bookstore, saying that we don't need no stinking panhandlers. That doesn't help homeless people. And that you shouldn't give money away to those poor panhandlers. Is that the new attitude in Santa Monica as well?
Absolutely. I think it's the attitude that is pretty pervasive in anti-homeless politics, is that you don't give to people in need. You give to companies that are there to serve the people in need. See, you don't give the gold to the homeless. You give the gold to the agency, and then they take care of the homeless.
Huh.
Doesn't that make sense?
Oh, well, yeah, definitely. It also provides a certain number of useful jobs to young college graduates and
professionals.
And professionals who need to pay the high rents in Santa Monica, but probably can't afford them anyway, even with those jobs.
Right.
Now, again, I'm going to slip back to what happened on January 3rd. You had a press conference and a criminal sandwich serving session?
Absolutely. We had groups who came out to Palisades Park, where we traditionally feed people, and we served a meal to poor people, which was in direct violation of the new ordinance. We did not have a permit, and the city has been quick to comment that we are uncooperative in trying to resolve this issue. And so we served the meal, and then all of the participants had signs, and we were chanting and marched down to the 3rd Street Promenade and had a march down 3rd Street Promenade past the Midnight Special Bookstore.
Well, wait a minute. I hope you didn't play any illegal music on the way or do any singing of any sort.
I think we were pretty loud. We probably busted the decibel ordinance.
but did you have a permit to play an instrument on the 3rd Street Promenade?
No, we certainly didn't.
Well, I would hope you follow that law at least.
Yes, and regardless of how many laws we would have broken, it was okay because we had absolutely no police presence. And we notified the police department that we were breaking law, and no one showed up to arrest us. So that was probably because, we had the National Lawyers Guild, the Los Angeles chapter, there with legal observers, and also they were the ones that hosted the press conference on the 3rd Street Promenade.
Send them north. We can use them. You might want to try what David Bush was trying a couple years ago. He he was making citizens' arrests, as you know, of people who were discriminating against homeless people in different circumstances. And if the police don't arrest you, you can have one of your own number arrest the entire group and demand that the police officer, you know, issue a citation for violation of a municipal code.
Oh, yes, but, I mean, we would have had to call 911 because we couldn't find a cop anywhere on the promenade.
Well, they were probably all busy dealing with the menace of homeless sleepers in other parts of town.
Right, sleeping them out of the doorways.
Now, in Santa Monica, you had a rather creative law that allowed for people to sleep in their vehicles, provided they weren't in residential areas. It was passed by the pro-homeless, how rare it is, former city attorney of Santa Monica, Robert Bob Myers. Is that law still in effect?
No, it isn't. And what Santa Monica has done is that they have strengthened a law that basically says that you cannot have vehicles above a certain height or beyond a certain length in any residential area. And then, of course, in the business districts, all of those parking spaces are regulated by time use or, you know, with parking meters and things like that. So basically banning vehicles above a certain height and certain length really eliminates all motorhomes or any vehicles that a person could possibly dwell in that would offer some type of comfort in the form of being able to stand up, store your belongings, and, you know, maybe cook a meal.
If you sleep in your vehicle, is that illegal?
That is not illegal as long as you do not receive any complaints from residents.
Really?
If a resident complains, and which really leads to the discussion of, you know, what do property owners really own? You know, they own not only their property, but they own their view, and they own the streets outside and down the street. So if a person happens to see you in your car with your clothing hanging up in the window and sees you sleeping in there, if they choose to call the police will come and they will issue an order basically saying you have 30 minutes to leave. And
that was the old law that city attorney Myers passed, right?
Exactly. And so then that would go into effect. And if you didn't leave, then you could be arrested. And so, you know, basically, you're still allowed to sleep in your vehicle, but in doing so, you know, it's a trap. At any moment, something could happen, and you could be removed. And basically, what happens is that during normal sleeping hours, which is anywhere from 11 p.m. to 5 a.m., that, you know, your sleep could be disrupted on a regular basis if anyone were to see you. And so that leads to anxiety, sleep deprivation, and a general feeling of panic in most people who live in their vehicles, you know, to stay moving.
How many people would you
be seen and to hide?
How many would you say live in their vehicles in Santa Monica?
We've estimated that there's probably about 200 people who live in their vehicles.
Well, why don't they just move south to Mexico, man?
Well,
it's
sure
cheaper down there.
People hope that they would.
They could learn Spanish.
Don't stop in Santa Monica. Don't stop in Long Beach. Don't stop in,
San Diego.
Anywhere. San Diego, just get out of town.
So,
and most people would be happy to tell you that in Bakersfield, there's a lot of
great job opportunities.
Warm, homeless, welcoming feelings there. So
yeah, and it's a warmer climate too.
Yes.
So, you know, we're working on the street performer issue up here a lot, and I'm wondering, or we're subjected to it, did the street performers ever organize to try to fight the laws that required them to get permits?
Yes, they did. In fact, they had, a very representative participation of the people who were out, you know, doing the street performances. And, as regardless of how many people they have, even if their numbers outnumber the number of businesses who are members of the Bayside District Corporation, their voices are not considered with the same power that the Bayside District is. And the Bayside District gets their way every single time. And anyone who organizes against it, it doesn't matter what you say, how much you say it, how many people say it, your law isn't going to be passed.
What about attorneys? Do they have any attorneys? We're talking here about how legal threats had kind of forestalled movement on musicians for a number of years. Were any people like the National Lawyers Guild willing to take up the cudgels for street performers? Or?
Yes. I believe Carol Sobel, did some work on preventing the free speech expression from being, imposed for people like Jerry Rubin, who does outdoor tabling, or like Making Change, who has street vendors, that they would be able to, distribute their literature. But there isn't much that can be done for, people who do performances, because I guess the free speech issue is kind of clouded when it comes to the, how public space is administered to it is administered.
Well, we had several interviews on this station with Robert Letterman. Have you heard of him?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, he's a very successful.
From New York.
Indeed. He's a successful litigant there who's been arrested 40-odd times and has never been convicted of anything. He's led street artists to resist the depredations by different New York mayors, including Giuliani and, I guess, what's his name, Bloom?
Who's now the new man of the year.
Yes, indeed. And he, the federal courts have found that art and music are protected expressions. You can't require permits for them in New York City. It seems strange that in a more liberal federal court area, we have a different situation. Has anybody actually taken those permit laws to federal court or not?
I don't believe that we really have the wherewithal. I think that if we all got together and paid an attorney to do so, we would be able to get it in court. But at this time, I think that there are so many ordinances that are coming out restricting so many activities in public, it's really hard for the ACLU or for the National Lawyers Guild to decide which battle to choose. And I think that,
of course, we have a much bigger war to fight, the war against Iraq and the weapons of mass distraction.
Right. And the war on war.
So how is the war against the war going in Santa Monica?
Well, a lot of people are coming out and making public statements saying that they don't want war. In Santa Monica, we really have, for our homeless population, one cold, wet weather shelter at the National Guard Armory that our homeless have access to, and there really is a lot of concern that if we were to go to war, that the National Guard would then take those armories for their use and basically leave people out in the cold. And though we've had, suggestions in the past to do outside organizing to prevent that from happening, Santa Monica and Los Angeles has really done nothing concrete to say, in an emergency like this, we will have, some type of alternative so that people don't end up out in the streets in the rain.
Is there, just more broadly, have there been any strong anti-war protests in Santa Monica in the last month?
In Los Angeles, there have been several mass demonstrations against the war, many at the federal building from people who are affected, people of color who are being targeted by the immigration laws and the restrictions and, this whole Nazi-type search for any persons who might be in any way connected to terrorism. And basically, from what I've heard is that there are many environmental groups and social justice organizations who are coming up in the new California anti-terrorism organization as being potential terrorists and are being called in by the FBI for, interviews.
Food Not Bombs and Making Change should be at the head of that list, right?
I'm sure we'll get the call any minute.
Well, so do you see growing anti-war sentiment down there, or do you see a kind of does it look like there's a strong movement to stop the war, or are people kind of just depressed?
Well, if I talk to the average person up and down the street, they're against the war. But then when you turn on the TV and look at mainstream media, there is a huge movement for war, and it's really hard to say, you know, who's really supporting this war when the average person is out on the street is against it. So, you know, regardless of, you know, anti-war sentiment, which I believe is huge and getting even more so, because, you know, people are you know, communicating with each other about this, you know, in putting out literature and, you know, talking about it in public through marches and demonstrations. But, you know, it's really hard. I think that's one of the tools that the mainstream media is using, is not acknowledging or recognizing this huge movement that is out here and kind of minimizing it as, you know, small levels of resistance or pro-terrorist sympathies, because, you know, if you're not with us, then you're with the terrorists, right?
So what about Venice? Venice is a near... The police backed
the
off.
Would come in, and the helicopters would fly over and basically evacuate everyone out of the area.
So have police backed off? Have police backed off, Jennifer, because of these protests, or have the people just dispersed and the concert makers gotten all concerned about their permits?
Well, you know, the concert goers basically, you know, either try to challenge, which, you know, if they do so, that's considered the riot. And, you know, the concert organizers, even though they have a permit in their hand, are left to working through the process after their concert has been, you know, dismantled in order to say, hey, you did something wrong. And after the fact, there's not much really they can do about it, because the police are basically, they can do whatever they want now. And I think to a certain extent, you know, our police in this area, you know, with the increased enforcement, has really put a stop to, you know, freedom of expression. And basically, you know, you can do it only for so long, but if, you know, more than a few people gather, they can, you know, either tell you to leave or disperse. So I think that, you know, as far as anti-war sentiment is concerned, it really prohibits people from coming out and, you know, in large numbers in order to declare that war is not the answer. And it's a tactic that they use to keep people from knowing that there is a significant movement of people who are against the war.
I know that the Democratic National Convention had the most frightening display of violence and force against protesters that I've ever seen in a major city in this country back in 2000. Does this seem to be kind of part of that mentality, or is it something else?
Well, you take a look at the Democratic National Convention and the efforts that the police department took in order to make sure that there was a large number of, you know, police out in riot gear, you know, to stop and quell whatever, you know, domestic disturbance might be happening in the form of a march or, you know, a parade. We recently had a march against police brutality, and there were hundreds, if not at least 1,000 cops in riot gear who basically surrounded the entire march route. And you know, it was kind of weird to see that kind of presence, and, you know, they were videotaping everything and taking pictures, and, you know, there were several confrontations, including with legal observers who were trying to mediate between the police and the protesters. And basically, you know, they really have to, you know, fight for their rights, you know, against the police, because, you know, they'll go against the legal observers and in order to get what they want, and any type of resistance is, you know, basically gives them the okay to quash whatever activity is out there. And so, you know, you can have a march that goes through downtown Los Angeles, but people being able to cross through the police presence to get to it is difficult, and being able to get out of the march itself is difficult, getting back out through the police. And so, you know, it's definitely significant, I think, of our times and, you know, the police state that we do live in.
You were in Santa Monica when the first Iraqi war happened, right?
Yes.
Did you notice a stronger level and a quicker level of protest against that conflict than is happening against this one?
Well, I believe that, you know, having a permit process for any mass demonstration has basically taken its toll. I mean, it makes it a lot more difficult to go through the public process in order to have a legal march. You know, by the time you get that permit and get everyone together, then, you know, it's a different day and issues change and things like that. But I believe that it makes it harder for people to go and organize, you know, spontaneous demonstrations against actions that are happening immediately on behalf of our government.
There wasn't that permit process in 1990?
Well, I don't think it was as restrictive as it is today.
We're talking with Jennifer Yellowhorse of Santa Monica. She's one of the editors. Are you the editor or one of the editors of Making Change?
I am one of the editors and production people of Making Change in Santa Monica.
You're also apparently one of the scofflaws who wants to allow homeless people to eat whatever is foisted upon them without the kind of stringent and important safeguards that... well, should we say, might reduce the number of peanut butter sandwiches, but ultimately would reduce the number of fatalities from peanut butter sandwich poisoning, correct?
Yes. I could at any moment distribute a potentially hazardous sandwich to someone, and,
so,
you know, I should be stopped. But I do think that, you know, to a certain degree, my having to economically relocate out of Santa Monica has, in fact, you know, given the city council this new, you know, perspective on people who have to come in from other cities in order to serve Santa Monica residents. So I have some council members saying, well, now that you live in Ventura, you need to go serve Ventura homeless rather than to continue your work here. You don't belong.
Now, David Bush, who was your co-worker, I guess, in some respects, he filed several lawsuits, one against discrimination in a restaurant, one against discrimination in a museum, and he was, I guess, able to remove the, what, no loitering signs in downtown Santa Monica?
A lot of the no loitering signs were actually not even based on law. And he managed to have that record. recognized by the city, and so they had to take down those anti-loitering signs. And one of the social service agencies here in Santa Monica, who is being touted as being, you know, the number one continuum of care available to homeless people, had these no loitering signs, which were illegal and not based on any recognizable law, and had them all over the outside of that property. So, you know, Santa Monica agencies clearly are very supportive of the city's direction in terms of, you know, removing homeless people in front of their doorways.
That's true up here in Santa Cruz. In Santa Cruz, that's also true, Jennifer. We have in front of the only really the homeless resource center, it's called, where people get their, there's a two meals a day and you can get lockers and so forth. There were signs put up before they appeared elsewhere prohibiting parking in the wee hours of the morning so people wouldn't park there overnight. And then and this proposal was actually suggested to city council and to members of the city council by the head of the homeless resource center as a way of dealing with problems in other parts of the city. So you, I think what you have is you have bureaucrats who want to protect their little piece of the pie. And, I mean, they can process a certain number of homeless people, but to deal with the homeless problem in a broader sense, they haven't got either the a clue as to how to do it or the resources to do it. And they're afraid that people will begin to notice that they're not really making much of a dent on the problem and will eliminate them from consideration unless they move the problem out of sight. What do you think of that analysis?
Well, I believe that they see the problem a lot differently than the average person who is out on the streets. And I think it's summed up in one of the comments that one of our city council people made in regards to the difference between vagrants and your average homeless person. A vagrant is someone who does not have a job and does not want a job and wants to be out on the streets. And a person who is homeless should be actively pursuing services and getting off the street as quickly as possible. And so the in-between problem that no one is recognizing is the fact that the social services themselves are not adequate to meet the numbers of people who need them and very often live out on the streets waiting for some type of service. And a lot of the social services that are being provided are services that don't necessarily do anything about homelessness, you know, and they say, well, we have our continuum of care, but basically it's get a job, get off the streets, and it does not in any way attempt to address the problem of people who are unemployable, who are completely unemployable, who for a variety of reasons would not be able to get a job, many of which have to do with disabilities.
One might say the
And in our city, you know, I think that they have the same feelings or sentiment that your city council and your social service providers have, is that, you know, a person needs to be actively getting off the streets and not being seen and not being heard, and get inside, do what we say, and when we do have a space for you, you know, come in. But basically, if you, you know, refuse to leave the city for those social services, to go to an outside city in order to receive care, then basically you're service resistant, and you want to be homeless, and you want to not have a job, and therefore you are a vagrant, and should be removed,
you know,
from
it's
public areas.
It seems to me that it's not so much homeless people that are disabled as the economy and the society that is disabled, as you have more and more jobs fleeing to, you know, countries where people essentially are engaging in a very cheap, if not slave labor, activity. And people here are forced to do more and more work to get less and less. And the idea,
and not only that, I think that there is this blindness to corporate accountability and how many people do have jobs or have had jobs who live out on the streets who do not have a livable wage and cannot afford to live in the same area where they work. And really, you know, if that person in any way, shape, or form has some type of problem where they can no longer work, if they're disabled on the job, or, you know, if they cannot afford afford to come into work for some reason, their vehicle gets towed, or and they get fired. You know, basically, if an employer does not want to pay you any type of unemployment insurance, then they don't have to. And there's no real measure of regulation to ensure that if a person claims that they were fired for, you know, some illegitimate reason, basically our, you know, employment department takes the side of the employer and will refuse to pay them their unemployment benefits. And that's something in our country that everyone pretty much refuses to look at, you know, is that there are a lot of valid claims that get knocked out because basically businesses are preferred over the average person. You know, their voice is heard and you know, agreed with over the average person. So, you know, there are a lot of ways in which, you know, corporations get away with murder.
I think it's mainly, they maintain a large labor pool for corporations, but that really is a subject for another day. Although that is
absolutely
the subject. That's the subject every day, unfortunately, in the reality. We've been talking with Jennifer Yellowhorse, one of the editors of Making Change, talking about the Santa Monica fight back against the Feed 'em and We'll Arrest You laws that are showing up in Santa Monica. You haven't been arrested yet, though, so I guess you're going to continue to feed 'em, and then they'll arrest you when there are no lawyers and video cameras around. Is that the plan?
Yeah, that's the plan, is that everybody will continue to feed until we're actually stopped. And hopefully what we're doing with this lawsuit is to put a stop to the actual, you know, enforcement of the ordinance until the, you know, case is considered in a federal court.
Is there actually a case being considered in federal court?
Yes, I believe that that's where they're trying to...
Someone was arrested for it, or...?
No, they just... The Lawyers Guild filed the federal
lawsuit. Oh, for an injunction.
On behalf of the charitable organizations who provide the food for the homeless and hungry in Santa Monica.
Well, you know, if you're going to continue feeding these people, I have no sympathy for you. And as far as I'm concerned, you should go to Ventura and enjoy a hot tub. That's all I can say. Actually,
well,
I appreciate you doing this work, Jennifer, and I'm going to roll on you now. And why don't you get in the last word, though? Is there any way people can help you? Let me ask you that before you go.
You know, people can help by getting active with their community groups that are providing these types of services in their own communities and, you know, making their voices well known to city councils, especially in Santa Cruz, in your area where these listeners are, you know, living, that, you know, you should say, this is what we want. We want community solutions to homelessness and poverty. You know, the average person should be able to provide services to the poor, and they should not all be institutional services that are allowed to serve homeless people. I think that anyone in the community should be able to choose when and where they want to help homeless people and how they want to do that. And it shouldn't be dictated by the government. So I would hope that your listeners would become more active and support the efforts that, you know, your group is doing in getting, you know, these laws overturned that are anti-homeless.
Thank you, Jennifer, and good luck. We'll be in touch with you. Maybe you can keep us updated on what's going on.
All right. I certainly will, as long as you're willing to chase me down.
We'll probably do that again.
Thank you, Robert.
Hey, thanks, Jennifer.
Good luck with everything.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Together to grieve the storm. La sun on the meadow is summery warm. The stag in the forest runs free. But gather together to greet the storm. Tomorrow belongs to me. The branch of an linden is leafy and green. The Rhine gives its gold to the sea. But somewhere glory awaits unseen. Tomorrow belongs to me. Herr Ludwig, sing with me.
The babe in his cradle is closing his eyes. The blossom embraces the bee. But soon says a whisper, arise, arise. Tomorrow belongs to me.
Everyone!
And that was from Cabaret. You're tuned to 96.3 FM. Tomorrow Belongs to Me, the song sung by the young Nazis in the film. And this actually was from the stage production. Phone line is 427-3772 in case you want to call in. And we're certainly going to be talking with former Homeless Issues Task Force member and former City Council candidate Thomas Levitt, who is going to be doing a radio show tomorrow in his own right between 10 and 12 Monday morning on KSCO AM. That will be at 1080 AM. And the phone number there, if you want to call him and be on his show and talk about issues around the city, one of which is the issue of homeless civil rights and services, is 479-1080. And I encourage you to call in at that time and respond to that show. I think he's going to be looking into issues around the failure of the City Council to respond to its own commissions. He himself was on the Living Wage Commission. He may talk about that at length tomorrow. I've asked him to call in and shortly to talk about the Homeless Issues Task Force, what's become of it, at least of its recommendations, which, is a $10,000 group that was spent 8 months running around the Maypole on Christopher Crone's motion after the City Council refused to pass any kind of meaningful changes in the sleeping van law. And there were a number of recommendations that it made. They were all pretty much dumped very quickly and unceremoniously and without much respect for City Council process. That was under Mayor Sugar, the time when I first began filing Brown Act complaints. Complaints that the City Council was not letting the public into the meetings, not letting them speak, not giving them adequate time to speak, shutting them up when they tried to speak, passing matters without adequate notice so that members didn't know that the City Council was passing something that they wanted to talk about, changing the times of when such measures were to be heard so people were confused as to when to come. And at this one session, I guess, on July 11th, which was after the June 25th massacre when Catherine Byers killed the safe sleeping zones. She was a former mayor and the swing vote on the City Council. She actually wasn't mayor that summer, but she was the key vote, and she voted with Rotkin, Matthews, and Hernandez to kill the safe sleeping zones. But really, Fitzmaurice had kind of undermined them, and Crone and Sugar had refused to stand up for them in a clear way until such time as they were literally being flooded with protesters. There was a coffee clatch going on in Sugar's office. David Silva had organized dozens of people to engage in a fast. Actually, it might have been several hundred at one point. There were massive marches to City Council meetings. There was the Pie and the Pusser Award. all this prompted Sugar to finally put forward a very limited and nearly unworkable program for safe sleeping zones, but still, it would have been a good first step. And when it was destroyed by propaganda from Rotkin, the Downtown Association, pressure from the Harvey West Association, misinformation from the police department, and the turning tale of former Mayor Catherine Byers, essentially, Sugar and the council deep-sixed all the homeless recommendations that the Homeless Issues Task Force spent 8 months putting together. And these included... Ah, we got an incoming call. Well, we'll go into what they included as soon as we get our man on the line. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
That's a problem, sorry.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
And who do we have here?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
All righty. And who are you, caller?
Thomas Levitt.
Thomas Levitt. I think I've heard that name somewhere before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been talking about your, well, your upcoming radio show tomorrow.
Yes.
On KSCO.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also mentioned some of your credentials, and I've mentioned that the Homeless Issues Task Force proposed a number of recommendations. I emailed you earlier the set of recommendations which they discussed and disposed of on July 11th, 2000. Did you actually get that email?
Yes, I actually at one point actually dug that whole thing up and examined it in detail to determine exactly what, if anything, the city council had done. And my ultimate conclusion was basically that they had done nothing. A large number of proposals were referred to, for example, for the Homelessness Services Center. And no report, I do not believe that any report was ever delivered back to the City Council from the Homeless Service Center about the practicality of any of these things.
Mm-hmm. You know what I could do, Thomas? I can read you. Do you have that report in front of you, or... Do you have the summary of the report there?
No, not at this point.
Well, let me read you a few of the recommendations, because you were on the task force, and you also have been studying them, and kind of ask if you remember what happened to them, or maybe just make a comment.
Sure.
Number three was the use of the vacant bay at the Homeless Services Center, I guess, as some kind of shelter. The Homeless Services Center provides no shelter other than access to churches and the armory for a small percentage of homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
Council deferred to the Homeless Resource Center to come up with a plan. Any comment on that?
Well,
where's the plan?
Yes. Well, I think that's pretty much exactly what happened with everything. It was referred or deferred or rejected or the council declared that somehow they'd already done it and none of it was implemented. And there was never any follow-up to see whether any of the plans had actually been, the referrals had actually been followed through and any plans had been created. I mean, you know, if you talk to anyone on the Homeless Issues Task Force, well, I don't know about anyone, but, I mean, my conclusion ultimately is that it was a diversionary tactic and a pretty much a waste of time in terms of actually generating something productive, although I think it was productive, and then it put a lot of people together that weren't connected before and, you know, generated a lot of useful information and knowledge. But I mean, as far as,
have they done anything since though, Thomas? I mean, you've become actively involved as an individual, but you know, Ken Cole, Paul Brindell, gosh, I don't know. I can't remember all the people who were on it. Linda LeMaster, I guess Laura Tucker was involved. And some of us, I guess, were out there yesterday tabling downtown.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we probably would have been tabling downtown anyway without the Homeless Issues Task Force ever having wasted a year of our time.
Well, you know, it's the project that brought me into the entire process and made me aware of all the issues and, you know, gave me a kind of a grounding in what happened. But, I mean, as far as the actual practical, you know, beneficial effects on the homelessness population of Santa Cruz, clearly it did nothing in that respect. I mean, it's just another tool that we can use to highlight the city council's hypocrisy. The city council, every one of the members who appointed, you know, the people to that commission probably had a pretty good idea of what they thought and, you know, what they were going to conclude, etc. It was a pretty broadly based commission. And so clearly the fact that we came back with all these very specific and tangible recommendations.
Let me give you some of those recommendations,
sure.
Thomas, and get your analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an action by the city council. I don't know if you can call it an action. Expanded armory time and for safe haven shelter. Those were two of your recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
The council instructed staff to continue to lobby state legislators on expanded use of the armory since the National Guard vetoed the idea and to report back to council. City Manager Richard Wilson stated he had spoken with Senator McPherson about the armory, but that the council should talk to other legislators to undertake the political process to get the armory shelter discussions back on track. Now, it's a pittance anyway, the armory. It doesn't serve people the way a tent city would, or some kind of rent control would, or meaningful affordable housing would.
Mm-hmm.
But did those armory shelter discussions ever get back, quote, on track? I think they're probably talking about year-round armory use, right?
Yeah, I mean...
For shelter.
As far as I can tell, I mean, from my perspective, essentially that's an action that's a non-action. Clearly the armory is being used year-round, and in fact, from what I can tell, its actual, you know, period of operation is shorter than it was before, and there was even the potential for losing it entirely due to the quote-unquote national emergency. So, the amount of energy and effort this council has spent on this has obviously been, you know, not all that great.
Well, I don't think they got the shelter discussions back on track anyway, because I think we're in the same situation we were in 2 years ago. The next one is family shelter. Number two, council discussed putting out an RFP to find a provider for a family shelter and to address it through a ballot measure to raise funds for such a shelter. Where's that at?
There was Measure U, and that passed, but with not enough votes.
That was to put an additional 1% tax or something?
Yes, that was an additional 2% tax
2%.
On the hotels in order to fund a family shelter. And I believe that the Homeless Service Center is in the process of raising funds towards the construction of a family shelter for 40 families or so.
I had heard that they have less than 50% of the funding they need.
Yeah, I'm unaware of the totals in that respect, but, clearly the amount of progress they've made forward on that has, you know, been less than, overwhelming, you know, given the fact that to maintain their state funding, for example, they had to tear down the old headquarters of the
Santa Cruz Service Corps.
Yes, because that destroying the building is progress.
Progress, right. It's like destroying the housing of the Dolphin Lee and Rex Court is progress. Number four, safe sleeping zones in city parks. Councilmember Rotkin moved, seconded by Councilmember Matthews, to delete this recommendation. The motion carried by the following vote. Ayes, Rotkin, Fitzmaurice, Byers, Matthews, Hernandez, and Sugar. Noes, Councilmember Crone. Any comments? Before you say anything, it's kind of ironic that they had this return of safe sleeping zones, or let's say at least a camping proposal in the parks a year and a half later with this proposal to sideline the Camp Paradise issue by supposedly giving it access to city parks, three of them anyway, if they did restoration projects and jumped through an incredible number of hurdles. Of course, that's never been used.
Right. Well, I mean, clearly, when you have, when you ask current or perhaps future running again council members how they voted on that issue of safe sleeping zones, there's six votes in one way and one vote another way in a pretty clearly documented recommendation, which I think that the city council should have expected us to come back with, and which actually, during that period, nearly every major activist organization in the city supported some form of safe sleeping zones.
Number five, Thomas, is medical emergency motel voucher program. Council funds this as an ongoing social service program with this year's budgeted amount, that is in 2000, the same as 1999's. Mayor Sugar recognized Lucy Kimmitzer's Homeless Issues Task Force, who stated, this is one of the few times that Sugar let anybody talk during that session, that the task force's recommendation was to fully fund the medical emergency voucher according to the amount requested in the budget hearings, which the council already voted for. So I guess you might say that this was sort of, was it a meaningless resolution, or was it impacted by the Homeless Issues Task Force?
I'm uncertain of the legislative history there. However, I am aware that quite often the money for that does run out. And I think it was our intention was to, you know, indicate to the council that they should fund this to the degree necessary to prevent that from happening, because, you know...
And unless funding it at the same level as the previous year, is that sufficient funding? They didn't accept your recommendation.
Well, I guess somehow our recommendation probably wasn't formulated exactly in the way that our original intent was.
Perhaps
but, I mean,
was,
you know, that was another example of the council just saying, I mean, if they'd already done it, then...
Well, it could be that was a result of our fine staff, former mayor and insider groupie Don Lane, who instead of having a homeless person appointed as staff member, we had this sort of revolving door council person who rotated on to a $7,500 a year job.
Well, you know, I actually think Don did a pretty good job, Robert, and the $7,500 or $10,000 a year job in Santa Cruz is a pretty trivial.
It's trivial if you're not homeless. Yes, if you are homeless, it can mean a great deal. But I mean, I have numerous concerns about Lane, which I expressed both when he was. Sorry.
I think we've had this discussion before, and
probably not on the air. And I don't know if Lane is so high profile now as to make it a significant discussion. But perhaps I should continue with the recommendations.
Yes.
Number six: safe, legal vehicular sleeping. Mayor Sugar stated that he had ranked this recommendation as a priority, but only in a safe legal area, such as a car camp. The Homeless Resources Center has been asked to come up with a proposal to fund someone to do outreach to find parking lots for people. I'm going to read that again. To fund someone, that the Homeless Resource Center has been asked to come up with a proposal to fund someone to do outreach to find parking lots for people to park their vehicles, and to fund such a program which will not be administered by the city. Councilmember Fitzmaurice stated he would research what Eugene, Oregon, and other jurisdictions were doing for safe vehicular parking. Did former Mayor Fitzmaurice ever get back to you on that one, Thomas?
Oh, my God. This is one of the things that just makes me want to laugh in a kind of despairing way.
Right.
I mean, clearly nothing on this has happened, you know, and essentially if you look down this whole list, I mean, all these things referred to the Homeless Services Center, was there any money accompanying any of these requests to have them do things? No. Is the Homeless Services Center going to make these things a high priority on top of everything else they have to deal with, especially if there's no money? No. Is this a way for the city council to say that it did something and it took action? Yes. Is it bullshit? Yes.
Well, wait a minute. You haven't heard the last of this, number six, safe, legal, vehicular sleeping.
Uh-huh.
Here council member Matthews, who was reelected, of course, this year, did move in a resolution seconded by Mayor Sugar to support greater utilization of existing programs that provide small-scale, dispersed, and supervised opportunities for vehicular sleeping. The motion carried unanimously. That includes our dear pal, Christopher Crone. Does that motion mean anything at all?
I mean, I guess you and I and all the other people I deal with are pretty much aware of all the opportunities in this area and all the actions and policy, and maybe someone from the city staff can, you know, illuminate
us,
but I certainly am unaware of any tangible results.
There were no programs developed for small-scale vehicular sleeping. All we have, I guess you can get arrested if you're sleeping in, you know, if you're sleeping in more than one vehicle parked next to another vehicle, you're likely to get arrested or at least cited and told or
so,
told to
I
move
mean,
on.
You know, that's, again, that's, a, I mean, it's part of this ongoing pattern of symbolic politics of passing votes which sound progressive but mean nothing and do nothing and are a waste of paper and citizens' time.
Yep.
So,
well, there are other recommendations. I think you had up to maybe 28 or 30 of them.
I don't recall the exact number. Sometimes it's I hear 30, sometimes it's 32.
Well,
I think it depends on how you formulate it and whether you include the initial series of emergency recommendations that we issued halfway through the process of coming up with these final ones, all of which were ignored.
Right, your recommendations were ignored. The other one was a letter on camping citations. This one, Councilmember Rotkin moved, seconded by Councilmember Matthews, to delete. And everybody voted for this except for, well, Fitzmaurice, Cronin, Sugar voted against it. This was the recommendation that asked for clarifications in how people were treated in the existing legal process. Essentially, it kind of shined a bright light into the Barisone Mulligan situation.
I'm digging real back into my memory. Wasn't this to prepare some kind of document that could be given to homeless people that would make it clear what their rights under these various situations were and how
I think
the
that was part of
work.
It, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was astonished when that didn't pass. I mean, you know, as far as the it's a completely trivial effort and is simply informing people of their rights. And so, I mean, clearly, if you look at the people who voted to remove that, I mean, what does that say about their fundamental, like, belief in informing people of their rights?
Well, according to this summary, which is taken from the City Council Action Agenda, I believe, or perhaps the minutes, Mayor Sugar then recognized Lucy Kinmetzer, another Homeless Issues Task Force member and a writer, who stated that the purpose of the letter was to be used as information for the courts and the defendants, and that it didn't specifically say don't enforce the camping ban.
Right.
But the next action is interesting because it relates to street, it might relate to street performers, it has to do with conflict resolution downtown. Councilmember Matthews, moved, seconded by Councilmember Rotkin, to delete this recommendation. The motion carried by the following votes, everybody but Fitzmaurice and Crone. Apparently Sugar doesn't go for conflict resolution downtown either.
Well, you know, it is quite interesting how this, you know, there's a continual pattern of, you know, Rotkin and Matthews. Was Kennedy on the council at that point?
No, Kennedy wasn't.
No, it was Hernandez.
Number nine is legal assistance for the homeless and very poor defendants. I'm rushing you through this, Thomas, because we're running low on time. The response was that the council is not setting up a program, but contributes significantly to programs such as legal aid. Mayor Sugar stated that although it was a good idea, he didn't think there was funding for the city to implement it. Mayor Sugar suggested that an ombudsperson, Proposal 24, could inform people of attorneys who took pro bono cases. Councilmember Byers requested that information be provided about attorneys who will take pro bono cases, such as the Senior Citizens Legal Services. Has any such information about pro bono attorneys ever been made available that you know of?
Via the city?
Yes.
I don't believe so. You can go to number 24 and see what happened to the omnibus person's proposal.
Action number 10, new police approach to drug overdose reports. Councilmember Rotkin moved, seconded by Sugar, to direct the police chief to respond to council in 60 days on how the police force can encourage people to call in drug overdose medical emergencies, given the problem that they may fear legal repercussions. This motion carried unanimously. Did you ever hear of any such reply within 60 days?
I do not believe that there was one, and I believe that I looked in the city council minutes subsequent to that, and I didn't see anything, but perhaps something did get slipped in at some point.
We'll see.
But, I mean, as far as it having a practical effect, I haven't heard of anything, and, you know, quite honestly, I don't think anything ever did come back, and I think that this city council, again, has a tendency to refer things to staff
yes.
to come back in 60 or 90 days.